From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Composer Philip Glass has turned 75 this year. He's having a heck of a birthday bash, a birthday year, premieres and revivals around the world. His latest symphony behind us here, number 9, premiering in Austria, his opera Satyagraha, playing at the Met, his 1976 Einstein on the Beach, back this month in France. His latest work performed in Carnegie Hall. He's written 9 symphonies, 26 operas, 50 film scores, including for The Hours, The Truman Show, Kundun. It's been a busy, boundary-stretching life. This hour on Point, we talk and listen with Philip Glass. Philip Glass joins me now from New York. On January 31st, he turned 75. New Year's Day in Linz, Austria, his new symphony, Symphony No. 9, had its world premiere. Word is that he's already written Symphony No. 10. His 1976 opera with Robert Wilson, Einstein on the Beach, is being prepped for a world tour which launches this month in France. And an opera about the life and death of Walt Disney, The Perfect American, will premiere in Madrid in early 2013. Philip Glass, welcome back to On Point. It is a pleasure to have you with us.
Hello, Tom. Glad to be here again.
It's great to have you. How do you come to a new symphony when you've written everything you've written? How does it stir in your fingers, in your soul, in your mind? Where does it come from?
Well, in this case, it was an important one because I began writing symphonies very late. I was in my 50s when I began, which is late. Really, I was a late bloomer as a symphony composer. I never expected to write this many of them. And by the time I got to number 7 or 8, I began to suspect that there were 9 was looming. You know, that's historically been the symphony everyone was afraid of because of it kind of killed off.
It was the last of Beethoven, the last of Schubert, Dvorak, Bruckner, Mahler. Oh, be careful.
By the way, what I did, the minute I finished 9, I wrote 10. So 10's already done. So now I just have to worry about 15, I guess.
Yeah.
Because that's Shostakovich. That's what laid him low. But in a way, you know, the funny thing is I had begun late. I wrote those 10 symphonies over a period of 20 years. So it was every other year. So they began to form a kind of body of work of their own, which I wasn't really so aware of when I began. But by the time I got to a certain point, I realized I had done a choral symphony. I'd done some with solo voices, string orchestra only. I went through the usual variety of symphonic writing that people can go through, and I had written my big choral symphony as number 5, so I didn't have to worry about that one again. But I think if anything, the one I was most interested in as a 9th symphony was Mahler's 9th symphony, and in a way, I would say the beginning of this has an echo of that, though I don't think anyone would notice it if I didn't mention it. I mean, it was just a very personal idea. When I began it, I didn't know where I would go with it. I knew we had a premiere on Carnegie Hall on my birthday. I wrote it about a year ahead of time because I was going to get busy that year anyway. So I wrote it. I finished the composition a year before. I just began and it turned out to be in 3 movements, but the interesting thing was that each movement had the exact same form. It was an ABA form each time, which is unusual for anybody. And to do a symphony in which each movement becomes a mirror of the movement before it, and in terms of the structure, was a very unusual idea.
Though hardly surprising in some ways for Philip Glass, right? For you. Well, I mean, that's you're incrementalist. You take a passage and you let it morph and repeat and morph and change. And I want to listen to just a little bit of this as we talk, if we may, Philip. This is Philip Glass's new Symphony No. 9, premiered earlier in Austria and then Carnegie Hall on his birthday, 75th, January 31st. Here's from the third movement. This is from the Austrian premiere. This was January 1st.
That's right.
The Bruckner Orchestra there, movement number 3. Symphony No. 9 from Philip Glass there, the third movement from the Bruckner Orchestra in Linz, Austria, on January 1st, New Year's Day this year. Now, at the very beginning of that, Philip Glass, we hear that kind of, what I think of as your trademark, the sort of swirling, repeating, incrementally changing kind of heartbeat of Philip Glass. And then something that comes, I don't know, in addition or on top that seems much more, in a way, familiar in symphonic terms, more traditional in symphonic terms. Have you become more traditional in some way as you've gone on?
It more or less had to happen that way because I began so far out in left field. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get further in left field than I was, so I started beginning going towards the center.
Crawling back.
It either works one way or the other. You either start very far out and then you come in towards the middle, or you start in the middle and you go very far out. It almost doesn't matter which way you start. You're going to cover the territory. And if you live long, if you're lucky enough to be able to work along years of your life and to live long, then you can cover a lot of territory. And that's kind of what I did. A lot of people still think of Einstein as the typical piece. But in fact, it was written more than 35 years ago. And we still perform it. It's still being done. And I like the early pieces. But I couldn't write them now. My brain is completely rewired since then. I don't think of music the same way. I'm very involved in performing the early music, so I'm still close to it in that way. But increasingly, I feel myself as an interpreter playing the music of a young composer who I dimly remember.
What a fascinating thing for a composer of a certain age, vigorous and producing like crazy, but 75. Let's listen back just for a minute. This is the 1976 Einstein on the Beach of Philip Glass and Robert Wilson. Einstein on the Beach, 1976, an opera that lasts about 5 hours, filled with that repetition, slowly morphing, this kind of effect of losing your sense of time.
Well, I hear that now, I think people call it a minimalist piece. I think it should be called rugged minimalism, something like that. It's pretty hard-hitting music.
Yeah, it is, and it leaves us wondering where did you pull this out? I know you spent a lot of time as a kid, in a record store. This almost sounds like someone who heard records spinning again and again and again.
I have a more, actually a more conventional background than that. I did work in the record store. That's true, but that music, that kind of repetitive music that you're hearing, it came about through my studies with Nadia Boulanger in Paris, who at the same time I was working with Ravi Shankar, his assistant. So I was working within two great traditions of concert music, one from India and one from Central European art music. And the collision of Ravi Shankar and Nadia Boulanger is what you're hearing. Actually.
Were you looking in that South Asian tradition to sort of create something transcendent until you fly off into ecstasy?
I got interested. No, it was more technical than that. Mm-hmm. I was interested in the way that rhythmic structure defined the overall shape of the music, and that is exactly what happens in the music. Most of the music outside of Western Europe, actually, mm-hmm. but specifically in terms of Indian music. It's a highly developed form of rhythmic structure, mm-hmm. Which informs the whole architecture of the music. And I became really interested in that. I began studying with Alaraka, who was mm-hmm. Ravi Shankar's tabla player. I took it very seriously. I went to India. Oh, I probably went to India 20 times in the next 15 years.
Were you thinking of technical composition, or were you considering the effect on the audience? Were you looking for an effect?
No, I wasn't thinking about that.
Well, Indian music
at all.
Certainly has an effect.
I was thinking about the language
mm-hmm.
of music.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say the effect on the listener is one thing, but you have to remember, to play this music was very difficult.
Yeah.
It took a lot of attention. There was no question. There was no drugs or alcohol going on. I mean, we could never have been able to count the music properly mm-hmm. if we had done mm-hmm. that. This was very demanding music for the musicians, and we got my ensemble got very, very good at it.
One from his Symphony No. 9. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with composer Philip Glass about his remarkable life in music, from Einstein on the Beach and before to his latest, Symphony No. 9, his work with David Bowie, Ravi Shankar, Allen Ginsberg, Woody Allen, and a whole lot more in between. He joins us today from New York. It's his 75th birthday year, and there are performances literally all over the world. You can join us if you followed the career, the music of Philip Glass. Were you listening in his early days when the world didn't know what to make of him? Did you? Were you there for 12 parts? Einstein, Kalyanis Katsi, Satyagraha. Behind us right here, the soundtrack for The Truman Show. He's in a lot of soundtrack score work for films. When it catches you, what's the magic in Philip Glass's work? How does it work? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Philip Glass joins us from New York. And Philip, we've got lots of callers for you already. The happy birthday greetings are here, I guess. Russell Springs, Kentucky. Jeremy's calling. Jeremy, you're on the air with Philip Glass.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question. The first thing is, Philip, I love your music. I've loved it since the first time I heard it. First thing I ever heard that you wrote was The Canyon. It was absolutely eye-opening, and I've loved your music ever since. So I have a question for you. Your music is immediately recognizable to me. In fact, I didn't know you were going to be on the show today, and as soon as I heard the music playing on the On Point intro, I was like, that sounds like Philip Glass, and as it turns out, here you are. So my question is, given that you have such a signature sound that's easily recognizable, and yet you've gone through so many different schools of thought and experimentation musically, how did you come to develop your signature sound, and how do you maintain it, even though you're exploring all these different genres and sounds in your music?
You know, that's an interesting question, because it comes up a lot. I don't teach formally, but I often have been at music schools and talked to music students, and what I tell them, I'll tell you what I tell them. And they're always worried about finding their voice. When you're a young composer, you're worried about, are you going to have a voice of your own? And I tell them, I say, you know, you're definitely going to have a voice of your own. You'll, by the time you're 30, you'll have it. But that's not the problem. The problem is how to get rid of it. Basically, once you find a voice, you don't want it to become a prison. You want to be able to continue to evolve and continue to develop. And the way I have done it, I in fact had to form a strategy for that. I worked a lot in the theater. That would be a dance and opera. Film is a theatrical form as well. Mm. That meant that I was working in a collaborative form with designers and dancers and writers, lighting people, people who do costumes. And what I found was that when I put myself in a situation where I was working with collaborators who were new to me, invariably I was placed in a position of finding a new music to fit something new that I hadn't seen before. It was this encounter that I continued. I worked this out for myself so that I would always have an encounter with someone who I didn't know. It could be a player like Fode Suso, a kora player from the Gambia in Africa, or Asher McIsaac, a violinist from Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, or Indian musicians that I've worked with besides Ravi Shankar as well. When I put myself in a room with someone who I had to work out some music with, invariably I had to do something new. It was that taking the step in a direction of finding a common language with somebody else that allowed me to continually evolve a musical voice. Now, in terms of did I ever get rid of the voice? No, in a way, I kind of failed at that. What I really wanted to do was get rid of it entirely, and I never was able to.
So when Jeremy in Russell Springs says he can recognize you immediately, is that a compliment or is that your worst fear?
Well, you know, look, when you see somebody walking down the street, even someone, a friend, you can recognize the way they walk when they're a block away.
Right.
You can recognize
if
someone who's cooking, you know, you taste it, you know right away who it is. We ooze our identities are inescapable. They precede us. You can get a whiff of somebody and you know already who it is. The problem is not the continuity. The problem is the change.
Keeping the change going and keeping it alive.
Interesting and for yourself. Now, another thing that has helped me, Tom, and Russell also addressed it to you, is that I've remained a performer. I began performing music, and I still do 30, 40 concerts a year, which means I'm always in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. Being in front of an audience is extremely rewarding and stimulating, and I think without that, I think without that other encounter, the encounter with a listening audience, they may not all be happy with the music. I mean, sometimes people say, you know, I don't like the music. What should I do? And I say, well, if you don't like it, you know, there's a lot of other music. Why don't you find something else? And,
you know, the world's a big place.
You don't have to like me. You don't have to like Shostakovich. You don't have to like Sammy Barber. Find whatever you like. In terms of the identity, any composer that you know well, you'll have that same experience with Russell, whether it's Shostakovich or Schubert or Bach. After a few measures, even after a few notes of one measure, you might know who it is.
Or Philip Glass. I wonder what it's like at your age, with all these years of reaction, to still hear the way people respond and characterize. We saw our friend Alex Ross at The New Yorker writing recently about, you know, your sprawling, churning, monumentally obsessive work of the 70s, and this kind of, he comes to it with a little fear or skepticism, and then he says the bliss kicked in. He was listening here. This is to Dance One, and he said it was a feeling of abstract intellectual delight, a pure interplay of musical and physical motion. You say you're revived or kept fresh by being in front of audience. And I want to come back to this sense of the effect your music has on the audience and the attention you pay to it. Is that what enlivens you? Is it its effect? Is it what they articulate in response? Is it the mood in the room?
Well, Tom, I don't really know what people are hearing. I know mm-hmm. that it means something to him. I don't know what it means, but I can tell from the reaction and the engagement that people have to it. And in a way, it's not even my business what they feel. I mean, I'm putting something in front of them that means something to me. That's number one. It has some emotional or some dramatic impact on me, and it has that with other people. But people have very different ways of experiencing mm-hmm. the same piece. We know that that's true. Mm. And nobody's right or wrong about it, but these are personal experiences. Music is art, poetry, dance. These are sublimely personal experiences for an audience. Why we have so many different people writing about a piece and saying very different things. Some people just don't like it.
It's really interesting to read. Justin Davidson in New York Magazine says, I found long, seductive stretches, this is in Philip Glass's work, that buzzed with energy or settled into feline languor. He's a master of texture and pattern, and roaming through his output reminded me of browsing among the great rolls of fabric arranged on racks in a Lower East Side upholstery emporium, endless lengths of sumptuous brocades.
Oh, it's wonderful. But, you know, but these are imputing to me powers of description and that I don't have.
Well.
I mean, I can write music, the listener, I mean, John Cage always said that. He always said the listener completes the music, and he was absolutely right about that.
Let's go way
Whether
back.
You like John, I always I loved his music.
Of course
him.
We do. Of course, we're completing, it's got a special tang to it.
Well, but it happens whether you're listening to it could be Sibelius or Vivaldi. We bring a lot of baggage to the experience ourselves, and to miss that is to miss this joy of discovery that people have, or the joy of hating.
Yeah. Let's go way back. 1969, Philip Glass, Music in Fifths. Early Glass, 1969, Music in Fifths. Philip Glass joins us from New York. Let's get a call from Susan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. And hi, Philip Glass.
Hello, Susan.
Hello. I'm going back. I remember Philip Glass and his music from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I was there,
building called the Whitfield Building, and was on a Ford Foundation Fellowship, I believe.
That's right, to be a composer in residence with the schools, yeah.
That's exactly right, composing for school children.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, he gave me his apartment and the furniture in it. And I
okay.
still have one
That's
table.
A connection, yeah.
those days. But that concert for school children was really astonishing. And I wonder, was that recorded? What has happened to that music, which was really early and was not symphonies, of course, but string quartets, as I recall, for children, and little brass bands.
Well, for them to play or to hear, Susan?
No, to Philip. Play.
To play, I see. And you wrote it.
This was in the days, especially in Pittsburgh, where the schools had a very highly developed music program, where music was considered an important educational experience for children. It's a great tragedy. We've really lost that. But for people that these were ordinary kids who weren't there to become musicians. They were just it was just a part of their schoolwork or even an option after school. I love that work, and I was very free to write whatever I wanted. I did it for 2 years.
Did it affect your composition? The fact that you had children listening or playing.
They were playing the music. No, they weren't. They were listening too, because we did concerts. Mm-hmm. I wrote for children to play string quintet, brass sextet, a whole bunch of choral music, symphonic music. Pittsburgh had a very a guy named Stanley Levine was the head of the music for the whole school. There was another fellow who was the head of the vocal music. I'm sorry, I forgot his name right now. I don't think they would. I don't think either of them would be alive now, because this we're talking about, I was in my 20s. We're talking something 50 years ago.
And Susan was there. The past never goes away. Well, Susan, thanks for bringing back that memory. I want to play a little bit from the great film Koyaanisqatsi. This is a kind of cult classic, just amazing visual images, and behind it the amazing music of Philip Glass. It's from 1982. Picture that, and with time-lapse landscapes and all kinds of wild emotion behind the definition. Koyaanisqatsi, from the Hopi language, we're told, meaning crazy life, life in turmoil, life disintegrating, life out of balance, a state of life that calls for another way of living. Gemli writes to us online, says, saw the film, was transfixed by the score, image and sound joined perfectly. For me, created an appreciation of this music it wouldn't have found otherwise. Underneath those minimalist figures, his, your Philip Glass, music can soothe, moan, and swing like nothing else. Lexington, Kentucky, Rick is calling. Rick, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hello,
Mr.
sir.
Glass.
Hello, Rick.
My introduction to Mr. Glass's music was the film Koyaanisqatsi, and I remember going in, it was advertised as a fusion of sight and sound, and that your senses would never be the same again.
I'm sorry about that.
That's pretty tall order, but I'd have to say that it was an incredible movie, and you know, I don't think my senses have been the same since. And I was curious as to, did you write the score to the video, or did they match the video to your music?
We did both. I was working with Godfrey Reggio, who was a filmmaker, and we worked as equals. We worked on a scene together. I would give him music, and he would cut images to it. He would start off showing me what we call an assemblage, just a collection of images that were going to be a part of a scene, let's say a 5 or 6 minute scene. And then I would write music for the images, and then he would cut the images to the music. And then sometimes we would rewrite it. And Godfrey was particularly interested, as you probably know, in the social issues that came up, whether with technology or social change. And his three movies that he does, Koyaanisqatsi, Poyaanisqatsi, Naakoyaanisqatsi, those three, he's doing a fourth one now. For him, they were meant to be educational, to reveal to you or to show you or to put in front of you the world that that you could contemplate and see how it was being changed by the way we human beings were changing it. I worked closely with him for more than 40 years now. He's a wonderful man to work with. And as I say, we're actually starting on a new project right now.
Rick in Lexington, what did it open up in you if it changed your way of seeing the world? In what direction, Rick?
Well, it kind of put visuals to music for me, kind of in a Disney-esque kind of way, but up several levels. I mean, it was almost Fantasia where you're blending sight and sound. And I think the way that it started out with the one long, I don't know if it's a cello note or something, and then it increased in pace.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ended, I guess, with that part of a rocket ship tumbling back to Earth.
That's right.
I just thought it was incredible. And I haven't seen the other ones, but, you know, I plan to.
It was an amazing experience.
You can find them online. They're available now.
Rick, thanks so much for calling. We're going to hear much more of and with Philip Glass. He's in his 75th year, or just after his 75th birthday now, January 31st at Carnegie Hall. Here's Passages from 1990. This was a collaboration between Philip Glass and Ravi Shankar, India's legendary sitarist and composer. You can join the conversation. What's your question for Philip Glass? Where has he taken you? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with remarkable composer Philip Glass, behind us right here from 2007, Songs and Poems for Solo Cello. This is song 5. With Wendy Sutter, Philip Glass's muse, companion. We had the pleasure of talking with them together a few years back when this came out. He turned 75 this year and is being celebrated literally right around the world. Austria, France, New York, you name it, around the United States. He's with us this hour from New York. What do you hear in the particular music of Philip Glass? And when it catches you, what's the magic? How's it work? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. How's it going with Wendy Sutter? The last time we talked to you, you were in her full thrall. Is she still your muse, Philip?
Well, she has a new piece of mine, which I haven't heard yet, but I hope to hear it. It's a sequel to that piece that you were listening to.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I got very interested in writing solo pieces. I wrote a big solo partita for Tim Fain, another great string. Oh, she's a great string player. Mm. I mean, Wendy's wonderful. And Tim is equally wonderful playing the violin. So then I did a double concerto for violin and cello. But that was with Maria Bachmann playing. And I think there's another cellist now. So it's kind of... I kind of got reintroduced to chamber music through that association, and mm-hmm. it's blossomed to a lot of other work now.
Have you left electronic behind, or is the instrument where you'd like to be?
I never really used it much, except in terms of presentation, in terms of amplified keyboards and that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually mix a composed electronic music with my music, but many people do, and it's a wonderful medium. There's no question about it. But I began life as a flutist, and I became a pianist, and I've always liked the world of acoustic music. In fact, when I'm doing film scoring, we're all kinds of, there can be sound designers involved with it. All kinds of things can happen like that, and I'm very much a part of the modern technology of. Digital technology where when I write a score now, it can be put into a computer and then we can make pieces longer or shorter and fit it to the film in a very different way than we used to. I work with sound designers and sound editors, and that world is very much open to me, though I do not compose with electronic instruments. It's just that I started in a different way. I mean,
how do you compose? How do you compose?
I have a pencil and paper, Tom. What could I tell you?
It's all in your head? A piano keyboard?
Well, a lot of it is, and I play it on the piano. Mm-hmm. And some things I can't play on the piano. For mm-hmm. example, that third movement of Symphony No. 9, I defy anyone to play that on the piano. Mm-hmm. It's very, very mm-hmm. difficult to do it. But my training is also in visualizing music, but then writing it down becomes I transcribe it that way. I don't write with a computer, though younger composers do, and there's a wonderful new kind of musical language that's developing with laptops included with the pianists.
I seem to recall that way back when you actually transcribed a lot of music from Ravi Shankar. That was
I did. That's how I met him. Mm-hmm. That's how I kind of began to learn that language. But we're just talking about the young composers mm-hmm. now who can take. I just have heard a friend of mine, Nico Moli, he was playing with a viola, piano, and laptop.
Wow.
And that's not uncommon.
Wow,
that's not.
That's
in fact, I've seen laptop quartets. Mm-hmm. On stage, where you have four,
yeah,
they're playing on the laptop. No, so there's another language going on now, which is a digital language. By the way, it's a binary language, which is very similar to the rhythmic grammar of Indian music, Indian classical music. So that's been a bridge for me. I've been writing with a binary rhythmic language for. Long before laptops wow. existed. So in a way, I've ended up in a parallel universe.
Bits and bytes and Ravi Shankar in binary.
I have to tell you that there's a young generation of composers. They haven't fully appeared yet, but I'm hoping I'll live long enough to see the fruits of that. But there's a wonderful new music that's starting to happen
the
now.
The door is wide open. Your listeners are here. Margo in Barnard, Vermont. Margo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have to tell you about a memory that I have many, many years ago, and it was probably from 69, standing in the street listening. I think it was a studio upstairs, and I was transfixed by the music. And I've never forgotten it. And I'm sure it was, I know it was Philip's music.
What, was someone playing it on their stereo set in 1969?
We were in Soho playing in Don Judd's studio. A number of people were outside. A few people were invited into the studio. It was a loft, but there were people out in the street, and I think that's probably what you heard. John Rockwell writes about hearing that. He's a writer who happened to be there, and he didn't exactly review it. He just mentioned that he was walking in the streets of Soho one night. I forget whether it was Green Street or Worcester Street. Yeah. And he heard this music coming out of the loft, and that's what it was.
Marco, where did it take you? What did it do for you, Marco?
It just transfixed me. It just captured my soul. I don't know what his music is. Is that it just does that? It's like something you just never want to stop hearing. I think that's why everybody was there.
Oh, Margot, I appreciate that you're bringing that moment to us. Imagine in the street in Soho, listening upstairs and transfixed. Let's get one more in motion. Joanna in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Joanna, thanks for calling. You're on with Philip Glass.
Hi, Tom. I was basically calling to express my extreme gratitude to Philip. I'm a classically trained ballet dancer, and about 7 or 8 years ago, I had started getting into more modern dance, and I was fortunate enough to be part of a piece that used music from The Hours. It was the Morning Passages track. And still now, 7, 8, or 8 years later, that is probably the most profound experience I've had performing on stage and being able to combine movement and music to allow me to express emotion.
Why? What about it, Joanna? With all your training and all your experience, what about this music from Philip Glass made that impression on you?
I think it's almost exactly what Philip was just talking about with, you know, his ability to visualize music and rhythm and have it change and go in directions that you don't expect, but still be a unified piece. It's just the music carries you and takes your dancing or movement or whatever you're doing that much further.
Oh, Joanna, thank you for that. Philip Glass,
I'm very happy to hear that, especially dancers. I have always had a strong connection with the dance world, and as a dancer, you would know that.
Do you write with a dancer's expression in mind in the case of the score for the Hours, or it just happens?
When I'm asked to write for a company, I go and watch the company. I don't. I did that with Twyla Tharp. I've done it with ballet companies. I don't just write for a abstract dancer. I want to see the company. I want to see what they look like, whether they're skinny or muscular or what kind of shoes they wear. I want to see it. I want to know as much as I can about it. Same thing with movies, same thing with plays or with poetry. I'd like to hear the poet read the poetry. So if I'm collaborating with someone, I want to get as much of a feel as I can for that. With operas, I go to the costume fittings, I go to the lighting rehearsals, and the lighting, the technical aspects are part of the deal for me.
Let's go to just last fall. This was November last fall, where your Satyagraha, and this of course goes back to 1980 or so.
1980, that's right.
80 performed live, brought back, revived at the Metropolitan Opera, and this is part of a trilogy, I guess you could say. Einstein on the Beat, Satyagraha, Akhenaten. This one composed as an ode to the life of Gandhi, a meditation on his early years in South Africa, his spiritual journey toward nonviolent protest. And there's a scene here we'll play a bit where movement leaders have been sentenced to jail for refusing to leave South Africa. The community resolves to protest by filling up the jail in the opera Satyagraha, getting themselves arrested for various offenses. Gandhi preaches about the importance of bearing no hatred toward anyone. Sarva, Bhutana Medra,
metra caruna, una e bacia, mirma munira, ancora sana.
Satyagraha, that's just last fall in New York, Truth Force. Charlottesville, Virginia, David is calling. David, thanks, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Philip. Philip, hello, I actually David. Met you in the early 80s when you played at the Pension Building in Washington, D.C., a place that had phenomenal acoustics, and Laurie Anderson also played there.
Yeah, I remember that place, very echoey. Yeah.
Well, but it also sounded amazing, you know, with your music, which I've been listening to for at least 30 years, and I'm a huge fan.
We were playing we were playing music in 12 parts at that concert, as I remember.
Exactly. But the relationship between Satyagraha, which Tom was just talking about, and the Occupy Wall Street movement, mm-hmm. in which you read from the libretto?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a demonstration after the last performance. The Occupy... It was Occupy Museum Group, actually. And
They came up to Lincoln Center.
Joined, mm-hmm. Yeah, I joined the demonstration after the performance. After the performance, not before. Yeah. And we did a mic check, and I used the text from the opera as the mic check. Well, it worked out nicely. I was very happy to do it. As you probably noticed, that there's a lot of social issues do come up for me in the theater and music and in mm-hmm. film. Mm-hmm. And I'm an engaged composer in that way. I don't particularly want to get arrested to have someone beat me over the head or have tear gas blown at me, but I will go and do things. And I'm very, very happy to be part of a younger group of people, especially a group that which I think has the power to bring real change in our political life, which I think we need. I think we all know that.
David, in Charlottesville, were you happy to see Philip Glass kind of take it to the streets there after the opera's performance?
I think it's great. He must be a very compassionate individual. And what a memory you have of even the show that I saw and some of the other events that people have brought up.
Yeah. Well, that particular hall was... That particular hall, I remember because of the sound of it, and and we had great difficulty hearing ourselves. But I actually enjoyed it. And things that are difficult to do doesn't mean that people can't participate in it. You evidently did. Thank you,
David. I appreciate your raising that, and also noting that memory. It is remarkable to think over all those years and performances how they can still come back. We've got the sound of that evening. This was in December last year, after the Metropolitan Opera's performance of Satyagraha, which depicts those struggles of Gandhi. And he walked outside. There was a group of Occupy Wall Street protesters there. And there was this mic check where you hear him quoting from Satyagraha in the sort of a Occupy Wall Street megaphone way
with a barricade and police all
around
us.
Yes, yes.
It was the whole deal.
Yeah, the whole deal. Here's the sound. Just so you can really understand what was said, he's quoting, he says, when righteousness withers away and evil rules the land, we come into being age after age and take visible shape and move a man among men for the protection of good, thrusting back evil and setting virtue on her seat again.
Tom, I have to tell you, what astonishes me, it never occurred to me that I would hear that on the radio.
Yeah.
We no longer have private moments anymore. Everything can be public. I had no idea that was recorded or I'm astonished, actually. But it was real, and I was very happy to be a part of it.
Was it thrilling for you to hear them sort of echoing about? And then
yes.
kind of talking
yes.
about street opera. That must be street opera right
well,
there.
Well, you know, for someone who was in I was in the streets in the 60s during the when Vietnam was still going on, yeah. And the street movement then got us out of Vietnam, no question about it.
There's a the video
and
of that.
And it's been a long time since then.
Our time grows short. There's video of that moment at our website, onpointradio.org. Tell us about, you have coming out next year, The Perfect American, premiering in Madrid in early 2013, about the life, and I think in particular the last months, the death of Walt Disney.
It's really the death of Walt Disney. And
why?
People think I'm making fun. I'm not making fun of Disney was a man who... whose imagination became global. I mean, the things he dreamed of and thought of have been known all over the world. He was probably one of the best, well-known creators of images that's ever lived. I mean, that's Disney. But like Disney, like everybody, he is a human being with wonderful parts of him and things maybe not so wonderful, but that's true for all of us. But what I was interested in, Tom, was the death of Disney. And the death of any great man, or whether it's a poet or a filmmaker or a dancer, I often said that it's when someone that unusual, when they die, it's like watching a sunset. It transfixes everybody. It's important for everyone. So I think the death of Disney was something that interests me, and the opera is about, in a funny, it ends up being about that. So I'm looking forward to that.
We will look forward to it as well. The death of Disney, The Perfect American next year, the life, very lively life at 75 of Philip Glass, which we are just thrilled about. We wish you happy birthday, Philip Glass, and good
Thank
luck
you,
with
Tom.
All your celebrations, and really fun to be with you today. Thanks so much for joining us.
I love spending the last hour with you. Thank you very much.
It's wonderful. We'll go out with Symphony No. 9, the latest, Movement No. 3, Symphony 10, already in the can. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.